From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. North Carolina lawmakers have been struggling with the best way to handle restrictions on distribution of craft beer. We'll chat with an expert who recommends more freedom for brewers. Does it make more sense to build the state's general fund or to tie various state government programs to specific taxes? Members of the North Carolina House's Tax Writing Committee recently tackled that topic. The state Senate recently rejected a proposal to set up a new mega-project fund for transportation projects. You'll learn why senators feared that new fund could threaten recent reforms. And you'll hear analysis of a recent court ruling linked to North Carolina's eugenics program. You'll learn why the court ruled against the estates of three eugenics victims. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Residents of a remote Beaufort County community say that a planned 600-acre solar facility could destroy the serene area that they live in and could also kill a private school in that area. The story unfolded at a recent hearing of the North Carolina Utilities Commission and is now profiled by Carolina Journal reporter Don Carrington. The newspaper's editor-in-chief, Rick Henderson, is here to give us the details. Rick, welcome back.
Thank you, Donna.
Tell us, first of all, about the school in this area that is pretty much the subject of a lot of concern.
Right, it's the Teresia Christian School, which is a small private school that's in a very remote area near Plymouth, North Carolina. It's been there for nearly a century. It's about 80 years old, and it is a real anchor of that community. The place is agricultural. It's not; it's very sparsely populated, but the school itself has been sort of the place where everyone goes, where the community meets to get together to do all sorts of events and to have gatherings and that sort of thing. And so it's a real important part of that community.
And that's typical of a smaller, more rural type area in any state.
That's correct.
In the country.
That's
the
correct.
School plays a big part. So the school is there, and it's very much a part of this area. Tell us about the proposal for a very big solar facility right near that.
Right. There's a company that's going to build a solar facility that's trying to get final approval for that would cover 650 acres of land that's currently farmland. And when the print edition of Carolina Journal comes out in July, we will actually have an aerial shot of this. And the farmland, the school is on 3 acres of property. The surrounding farmland is 650 acres. So as you can probably imagine, this is going to dwarf the territory that the school currently covers. And the company getting this has gotten this, it's getting its certificates of public, not a public need, but the certificate of public acceptance to operate the farm. And essentially what the people who are in the area who don't want this solar facility there are arguing is that the process that you have to go through to get a renewable energy facility approved by the Utilities Commission is very much biased against anyone opposing it. That the Utilities Commission simply has to say that if the proposal meets local land use restrictions, if the local elected officials say it meets local land use restrictions and local land use policies, then unless there's some major problem that is in the process of building the facility that's foreseen as a design issue or something like that, then it's nearly impossible for these things to get stopped. And this project is almost certainly going to be approved by the Utilities Commission because it has no justification not to do so.
So it sounds like the Utilities Commission really looks at just technical specifications?
Yes.
And does a project meet A, B, and C, or does it not? And if it does, if it meets the rules of
yes.
the area, then it gets approved. Rick, your description of the facility juxtaposed against the smaller, much smaller school is interesting. Is that the issue here? Would the school essentially be surrounded by solar panels?
Yes, it would. It would be surrounded. It's on one corner of the property, and if you look in two directions around it, then there would be nothing but solar panels, and the solar panels themselves will be 6 to 10 feet off the ground. So it would certainly be a visual issue. There's no requirement for the producer or for the contractor who's building this facility to provide any sort of visual barriers, no fence. I mean, there will be some fencing, but nothing attractive at all that would certainly prevent it from interfering with the, you know, with the view of the solar panels from the school itself. And on the other two sides of the school, they're roads. So it's not as if there's something else that can be done to shade, you know, protect the school from the visual eyesore part of this, which is what the part of what the community complaint is. And the second thing is that because these solar panels are going to be in former farmland, then there's nothing going, there will be no vegetation that you can tell of necessarily growing there. You could have issues with water problems, with vegetation issues, with vermin, with other sorts of things that typically you would be able to monitor pretty easily if the ground were open.
So there are health concerns? Is
yes.
that part of that?
Yes, they're concerned about water quality potentially. They're concerned about things like snakes and rats and stuff like that. I mean, because they're, again, you know, if you have open farmland and you have issues with snakes and rats, that tend to take care of themselves, or predatory birds tend to take care of those sorts of issues. Or if you're actually tilling the fields, then the people who are tending the fields will take care of those sorts of problems.
Do we know who owns the land or owned the land, or is this being leased, or what's
well,
the history?
Part of this that we have not that's going to be in subsequent reporting in Carolina Journal is that this land was owned by a single farm, a single individual who is an elderly gentleman. And there's some dispute about whether or not he actually was of sound mind, if you will, when he agreed to sell this property or lease it to the developer. And so there's some the family members are disputing the mental soundness of
and the circumstances under which
that
transaction took place. Because it seems pretty interesting to me, Rick. And of course, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal being the journalism arm of the Locke Foundation, very concerned about property rights
yes.
issues. And so it seems like there might be a tug of war there between an owner's right to do whatever they want to, essentially, within legal requirements. With their land versus the community and how they feel about
right.
the changes that would take place.
And the other issue involving, too, of course, again, is the person who's making this decision a capable, responsible person who's making this decision, you know, reasonably? Or is this something – was there some element of, if not coercion, at least of persuasion that was out of line with what the actual family wishes were? And then the other issue that we haven't even addressed yet is the fact that this solar power – will not be going to help North Carolina meet its renewable energy requirement because it's not going to be connected to the local power grid that's used for this purpose. It is not, they have not applied for any renewable energy credits. So therefore, this is going to be much like the Amazon wind farm that we've reported on regularly, in which the power is going to go on the grid. It's going to be claimed by some third party, some other entity we don't know of yet, and North Carolina actually is not necessarily going to benefit from this energy at all.
It's an interesting question about the whole solar industry in North Carolina. Why are we seemingly ground zero for the growth of this industry?
Part of it is you have an awful lot of farmland in rural areas of the state that may not be as productive to be an agricultural resource as it would be to be a tax write-off, if you will. A lot of this land is leased to sharecroppers, if you will, basically. It's leased to people who don't own the property. And so the property owner is essentially figuring out what the best and wisest use of his property and money. And it may well be to lease it to another company that will then use it for another purpose, whether or not it's agriculture. And that's a real concern right there.
Also, the issue of how much subsidy there is to renewable energy. playing a factor in this?
Basically, yeah, yes, because right now there's a federal tax credit that's a big deal right now, and that means that the people who develop this land and put on solar panels, they can get very, very much of their tax liability relieved by using this for renewable energy rather than using it for farming.
So you can read this story that Rick and I are talking about at carolinajournal.com. We've been talking with Rick Henderson of Carolina Journal. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at carolinajournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Craft brewers in North Carolina are trying to change a state law that forces them to work with an outside distributor once they've grown beyond a certain size. One person who's taken an interest in this issue is Chris Koopman. He is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on again.
Why is this something that the Mercatus Center is interested in?
Yeah, so I think why is this something that I'm interested in? I think it's a great example of a couple of things. I think it's a great example of the way that entrepreneurs can create amazing products. You look over the last 10, 15 years and you see the boom in craft brewing across the country, and you see people who are trying new things and they're experimenting, and you see someone who takes an idea and turns it into a business. So you have people who go from home brewing to micro brewing to craft brewing, and they're turning hobbies into careers. I think it's just a great example of the entrepreneurial spirit and the way that people can be extremely creative and create products, quite frankly, that consumers love, as you can tell.
And also then an example of where government steps in and creates an obstacle for these entrepreneurs.
Right. That's the other side of the story here is the obstacles that a craft brewer faces. So just to put this into context, the craft beer brewing in general, but craft beer is regulated at the federal, the state, and the local level. So before you can become a craft brewer, you have to go get what's known as a brewer's notice from the Alcohol, Tobacco, Tax, and Trade Board, the TTB. It's within the Department of Treasury. You have to go through a number of steps. And then once you get that from the federal level, you can go to your state. So here in North Carolina, you go to the TTB. Then you come to the state. They give you permission. You go through another round of hurdles and pay fees and wait times. And then you go through your local level. All of this in addition to the regular natural startup costs that any business faces, you know, becoming really good at producing your product, buying all of the machinery and technology necessary to do this. All of those are faced by craft brewers, but they're also facing some tremendous regulatory barriers to entry, so much so that the wait times, fees, and costs added up here for a craft brewer, let's say in North Carolina, is about as equivalent to starting a legitimate business in China or Venezuela. So, just extraordinary barriers to entry that these entrepreneurs are facing on a daily basis.
There are a lot of things that the craft brewers could be challenging, but the one that really is drawing headlines is this distribution requirement, that once they grow past a certain point, if they want to continue growing, they would have to work with an outside distributor. Mm-hmm. What's your take on that requirement?
Yeah, so I think to see the self-distribution exemption that these small brewers are able to distribute their beer themselves, you have to first understand the three-tier system. So the way that it works in most states is as a brewer, you cannot sell directly to consumers typically. The brewer has to sell to a distributor, the distributor sells to the retailer, and then the retailer sells it to you as a consumer. Now, a number of states have created exemptions over the years. So these are laws that were created 1930s, post-prohibition, when the power to regulate alcohol was given back to the states. States created these in the name of consumer protection, right? To raise the cost and increase the distance between brewers, people making alcohol, and people consuming alcohol for their own good. But the market has dramatically changed. And so in recent years, states have come up with these self-distribution exemptions that say if you're a small brewer, if you're making 20,000 barrels a year, 25,000 barrels a year, you don't have to go through a distributor. You can sell directly to the retailer or you can sell directly to the consumer. Now, as brewers have gotten bigger, that is both the number of brewers and the size of these breweries have gotten bigger, there have been more calls for increasing the cap. I think at the end of the day, whoever owns your distribution owns your business. As a brewer, if you're not in control of getting your product to consumers, you're not in control really of your business. So I would say any mandated restrictions like this are getting in the way of allowing these entrepreneurs. Again, these are people taking hobbies sometimes and turning them into amazing products that consumers like. They should ultimately be in control of when, where, and how they're sold to consumers. They should be able to have direct access to their consumers. I think that makes for a better product. And ultimately, creating these the three-tier system, while maybe well-intentioned 80 years ago, probably doesn't make sense anymore today.
That is the voice of Chris Koopman. He is with the George Mason University's Mercatus Center. And you mentioned that this is something that's not unique to North Carolina, but how does North Carolina's cap stack up with others across the country? Is ours particularly egregious, or is it unfortunately right in the mainstream?
Yeah, it's just about mainstream. You know, I think North Carolina is pretty average when it comes to the self-distribution. I think North Carolina is a little better than some states, but again, there are other states that are doing it better. But again, even the things that North Carolina is getting right, it's still a far, far cry from just opening up the market and allowing these craft brewers to experiment, produce, and distribute their beer to people who want it.
Based on where things stand now and what the craft brewers are looking for, if they get the lifting of this cap and can grow more without having to work with the distributor, what could be some of the positive benefits we'd see economically?
Yeah, so you could see a number of things, right? The lower cost to getting into the market might mean that more people might decide to create craft breweries. You might see more selection. Even in this world we live in today where it seems like you could have a new beer every day and still never drink all of the new craft beer that's popping up, just even in a state like North Carolina. I was in Iowa a few weeks ago, just to give you an example, and there was a bar that only sold Iowa beer, and they had something like 60 beers on tap. I mean, just a crazy amount of selection. I think what you'll get is more selection and more competition, which means a higher quality product and ultimately lower costs for consumers. So people who enjoy craft beer, they'll be able to get more of it if they want that. They'll be able to have more selection if they want that, and they'll be able to have it at lower costs than they're probably paying today, because you're cutting out two and three levels of the distribution chain that, quite frankly, aren't serving much of a purpose other than to stand in the way between consumers and brewers.
You mentioned Iowa. Would you list that state or any others as an example to which North Carolina should really turn for ideas about how to do this right?
Yeah. So I hate to say it, but there's really not a good example, right? Like no one state has the ideal system. They all have some problems. They all have quirks. But I would say for North Carolina and people interested in improving conditions for craft brewers, the focus should be on holistic reforms, not just creating an exemption, like a 200,000 barrel exemption for self-distribution. It should be getting to the root of the problem and saying, if it's okay for small brewers to self-distribute, why shouldn't it be okay for larger brewers to self-distribute? And creating an even playing field where all brewers can compete on the same level field and not have to worry about what particular law may or may not be there. Because when you focus on the self-distribution caps, and you've seen this in a number of states, for example, is all of a sudden they decide to lower the self-distribution caps. So then all of a sudden a brewer that was brewing thinking they'll never have to worry about a distributor or a distribution contract or anything like that, all of a sudden the legislature says, you know what, we changed our minds. and now you're going to be a part of the system. So I think removing that uncertainty and allowing craft brewers to invest in their business, you know, expand opportunity for people to work in the industry and choice for consumers.
Well, one person is going to be watching very closely as this issue moves forward in North Carolina and across the country is Chris Koopman. He is Senior Research Fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Are you looking to make North Carolina more free? The John Locke Foundation is, and here are three things you can do today to help us make it happen. First, know the facts. Visit johnlocke.org for data, analysis, interviews, and more. And read carolinajournal.com to learn what government is doing with your money. Second, influence the debate. Invest in the John Locke Foundation's work with a tax-deductible donation. You can get it done in less than 90 seconds at johnlocke.org. And third, make North Carolina more free by sharing the message of freedom. It's easy when you visit johnlocke.org. Click on shareables, download, pass the messages of freedom to your friends, print the messages and mail them. Or if you're a savvy computer user, share the message of freedom on Facebook and Twitter. Know the facts, influence the debate, and share the message. Three things you can do today to help us make North Carolina more free. Get started today at johnlocke.org.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During a recent state budget debate, lawmakers haggled over a tough question. Does it make sense to tie specific revenue sources to specific budget items? The conversation started with Republican Representative Julia Howard. She wanted to change the way the state divvies up money from deed stamps.
30% would go to parks and recreation, 30% to the clean water, 30% to the coastal stormwater mitigation fund, and 10% to the North Carolina Agricultural Development and Farmland Preservation. It was the purpose originally when the deed stamps were increased.
The State House's top budget writer, Nelson Dollar, objected. He says lawmakers have made a conscious effort to eliminate small dedicated funding streams.
One of the things that was determined between the House and the Senate was to pull in all of various revenue sources. There are a number of revenue sources out there that were dedicated to specific items or programs. And when you do that, you don't strengthen your you might serve a particular purpose, but you're not strengthening your general fund. The determination was that In the long-term best interest of the general fund and of the best practices in terms of budgeting, not simply in North Carolina but in any state, is to have as strong a general fund as you can possibly have, because that's where your main appropriations are actually going to be done.
Republican Representative Jeff Collins sided with Dollar.
When I first saw this, I really didn't have strong feelings for it one way or the other, but the more I think about it, there is a certain amount of wisdom to funneling our revenues into a general fund and then appropriating them out from that rather than having a bunch of little individual funding sources going to specific targets. The reason for that is there's no guarantee that the amount of money coming in through one of these revenue sources is going to actually match the need of the departments or funds that you're funding.
Dollar explained why dedicated revenue sources can cause problems for lawmakers.
The problem that we've been that we tried to address over a course of a number of years is pulling all of these funds into the general fund, all these funding streams. So you have a little funding stream funding this and that and something else and something else and something else. And what you do is you weaken your general fund. And it's not just a issue that we deal with in North Carolina. It's an issue that's dealt with in most states. And best practices, no matter what state you're in, is to strengthen your general fund. That's the fund where you want to make sure it's a healthy fund so that you can afford to do what are your absolute highest priorities.
You've been listening to Debate about the best way to spend North Carolina's state revenue. Put as much of it into one large pot as possible, or dedicate specific taxes and fees to specific programs. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Are you tired of fake news? Well, you won't find it here. At Carolina Journal, we don't make things up and we don't presume or assign motives. There's no simpler way to put it than that. We're proud to say that honest, factual, rigorous journalism is the Carolina Journal way. Our reporting team is focused on accountability in government and policymaking, no matter which political party is in power and regardless of the person taken to task in the story. At Carolina Journal, we're beholden to the truth and to transparency. Unlike fake news, lies, innuendo, questionable sourcing, all meant to create controversy, not inform the debate. So the next time you're confronted with fake news, log on to CarolinaJournal.com or pick up the latest print edition. You'll find compelling news reporting from a team that knows what it means to be real journalists, committed to truth. Carolina Journal, you can count on us for the facts.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. When a bill is struggling to win support in the North Carolina General Assembly, it's rare to see a vote. Advocates usually ask instead that the vote be delayed. But observers of the North Carolina Senate witnessed an interesting scene recently. Not only did senators vote against a bill, they voted against that bill with near unanimous agreement. The subject of their opposition was House Bill 110. It started life as a bill requested by the State Department of Transportation and the Division of Motor Vehicles. But Republican Senator Jim Davis explained to his Senate colleagues how that bill changed in the House.
Basically, it's an agency bill to clean up some policy, and it's pretty self-explanatory if you read the bill. The only difference is in Part 3, which was added in the House, a section was added dealing with mega projects. Mega projects are defined as those projects above $200 million that have regional and statewide significance that could be paid for with highway trust funds. And it would be determined by, if you look at Section 17 of the bill, this would be determined by a work group in consultation with DOT. And Section 17 defines how this work group is going to be populated.
But after Davis's brief explanation, it was clear that House Bill 110 faced some problems.
We are in the process of preparing an amendment. My apologies. We are that amendment is not ready, and so we won't be running that. So I'll be glad to attempt to answer any questions about the bill. So I and some other individuals within transportation might be able to give you some historical perspective on the mega project funding. So I commit the bill to you and be glad to answer any questions. Thank you.
Republican Senator Kathy Harrington served as a lead sponsor for the Senate's version of the original House Bill 110. But Harrington had nothing good to say about the amended version that added the language about mega projects.
Not that long ago, just a few years ago, I stood in this chamber and asked my colleagues to support House Bill 817, which is we now know as the STI. It is in place and it is working. This bill with the DOT DMV portion, which I would support, I do not support the mega projects portion because, in my opinion, it goes directly behind the back of the STI, which is currently working. The STI is some of the best work that we've done since I've been here, and I would urge you to vote against this bill.
STI stands for Strategic Transportation Investments. The program was designed to add data and remove political considerations from decisions about transportation building projects across the state. Harrington wasn't the only senator to raise concerns about the impact of the mega project bill on STI. Republican Bill Rabin echoed Harrington's remarks.
I will parrot some of the things that Senator Harrington said and go a bit further. Just a few years ago, North Carolina was not seen as a good place to do business. Now it is seen as one of the best places, if not the best place in the nation, to start a new business. There are a lot of reasons for that. The long-touted Routronomics is one of them, and one that we should all be proud of because we have a very competitive, very good tax code in the state now.
Rabin's reference to Routronomics refers to retired State Senator Bob Rucho, a leading state tax reformer. A better tax code isn't the only positive reform in recent years, according to Rabin.
Another one is, and I'll give you an example in a moment, is the STI and our passage of that bill. And ladies and gentlemen, we did that in a bipartisan way. And we did that in a big bipartisan way. And we have done all of our transportation issues since we came here in a bipartisan way. And I hope that continues. Because good transportation policy affects every county and every person in this state. It is not a one-sided issue ever. We took the politics out of transportation, and that was a huge step. And the world took notice when we did that. And to go back on that and to put politics back in is a step backwards. It's not a step backwards to last year or the year before. It's a step backwards into the last century and what was going on a couple of decades ago. I don't think we can afford for that to happen.
Rabin pointed to a specific example of the way in which STI has led to benefits for North Carolina in recent years.
Folks from CSX came up from Jacksonville, Florida, when they were talking about putting in their project over in Johnston County and then in Nash County and here and there and around. And they hung with us. And we're going to see that. It's going to be a great boost to the state of North Carolina. And the executives of that company sat down with Senator Harrington and me, and they didn't have to. They came up, and they came up to say this. They came up to say thank you. And that was a big gesture for them to come up, to sit down with two state senators and say thank you. And what they wanted to thank us for and what they had to say was, we believe in North Carolina because when you folks make a promise to business, you keep your promise. And to industry like ours that has to plan into the future, we need certainty. And the North Carolina Senate has given us certainty. Because we know that you will not go back on your word. To go forward with this measure today would be going back on our word. And I don't think that's something that anyone in the Senate wants to go home saying they've done.
Republicans weren't alone in praising STI and panning the mega project plan. Democratic Senator Floyd McKissick added his voice to the chorus.
I want to thank Senator Raybon and Senator Harrington for their remarks. They're absolutely on point. SDI was a process that was well needed, that was well deserved, that tried to depoliticize road construction in this state. And I supported it 200%. We cannot turn our back on that process. When we establish rules, process, and procedures, we need to follow them, even if they don't always create the outcomes that we would prefer. What we're essentially doing here is creating a new, I hate to say it, political slush fund. And it's the wrong way to move it. We need to reconsider this language that's been added to this bill because it takes us a giant step backwards in terms of prioritization of DOT projects in this state.
So how did the bill fare? Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest called for a vote after a brief debate.
Question for the Senate's passage of the committee substitute to House Bill 110 on its second reading. All in favor vote aye, opposed vote no. 5 seconds be allowed for the voting. Clerk will record the vote. Two, having voted in the affirmative and 43 in the negative, the committee substitute House Bill 110 failed its second reading and it lays upon the table.
43-2 against the bill. And it got worse. One of the yes votes changed his mind. The final tally was 44-1 against the House's proposal for a new transportation program targeting mega projects. It was a rare case of a legislative chamber taking such a lopsided vote against a bill. It also marked a bipartisan endorsement of the strategic transportation investments process. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal Radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. It was a horrific period in North Carolina history that ended in the 1970s. It was state-sanctioned sterilization of thousands of North Carolinians against their will. Now, North Carolina was just one of many states that engaged in eugenics. And now, a North Carolina Court of Appeals ruling inscribes yet another chapter in the history of this terrible program. John Guzet is the John Locke Foundation's Director of Legal Studies. He's been following the eugenics situation and joins us now with an update. John, welcome back.
Thanks, Donna.
I don't know any other way to describe it than horrific, that period in history. Remind us of what the state of North Carolina did, to whom, and why.
Well, the program started in 1933 when the General Assembly created the Eugenics Board, the State Eugenics Board, and gave them the power to involuntarily sterilize anybody they thought was not fit to procreate. It went on for over 40 years. The Eugenics Board wasn't disbanded officially until 1977, and they were certainly still engaging in involuntary sterilization into the 1970s. Almost 8,000 people that we know of were sterilized under this program, and some were even sterilized without recourse to the State Eugenics Board, but simply by local authorities. It was a shameful business, but it wasn't uncommon. Most states did similar things, at least up until the 1940s. What's unusual about North Carolina is that we went on doing it for so long.
What was the thinking behind this? Because when you say sterilizing people so that they couldn't procreate, essentially we're saying there were people who were deemed to be unfit to have children.
Exactly. It was a one of the major planks in the whole progressive program was to not only redesign society, but to redesign humanity. And the way they were going to do that back then, because, of course, they didn't have things like genetic engineering, they were going to do it by preventing unfit people from having children.
Now, this ended in the 1970s. Several years ago, the legislature put forth a program that was approved in order to compensate the living victims of eugenics in North Carolina. Give us a sense of what it was that the legislature decided it wanted to do.
They appropriated $10 million, and they said that any living victim who qualified and came forward and applied with us before a certain date would get an equal share of that compensation amount. They acknowledged that this was something that the legislature had done that was wrong, and this was their way of trying to make at least partial amends.
The legal battle began over the fact that the law talks about wanting to compensate the living victims of eugenics, correct?
Correct.
And that created a question in the minds of those folks who are heirs of people who had been victims of eugenics. That went through the court system, and we've had a recent Court of Appeals ruling, the North Carolina Court of Appeals. Tell us what the court decided.
Well, the court decided, as I expected them to do, that the heirs of people of eugenics victims who died before the cutoff date would not be eligible. Their argument was that let me back up and say that the point of an important element of the law was that it limited compensation to people who were – to eugenics victims who were alive on a certain date. And the reason they did this was because – well, lots of reasons, but one of the main one was that they wanted to help people who were still alive who'd been harmed. Now, because there was going to be a gap in time between when the law was passed and when – compensation could actually be paid because there was a law had to be implemented, people had to apply, decisions had to be made, and so on. There was a concern about people who were living victims at the time of passage but might die in the interim. So the law also stated that for them, there would be a vested interest in the compensation amount, whatever it turned out to be, and that could go to the heirs. This was the argument, or this was what concerned the heirs of people who did died before the cutoff date. They said, why shouldn't we get a share of the compensation if the heirs of people who were alive at the time the legislation was passed but died before the compensation was paid got a share? That was the equal protection argument. They said, we're the same. We should be treated equally. But the Court of Appeals didn't agree. They said they're not the same. And in any case, the relevant comparison isn't between the heirs of people who died before the cutoff date and the heirs of people who died after the cutoff date. The compensation program was about living victims. And you can't – equal protection doesn't mean that the heirs of one group are should be treated equally with the actual living victims of the eugenics program.
With this Court of Appeals ruling, John, does that mean this is an end to that question?
Well, we don't know yet. It's possible the heirs will appeal. This was a Court of Appeals decision. They could appeal to the state Supreme Court, which would cause further delays. But I hope they don't, and I'm somewhat hopeful that they won't, because this was a unanimous decision by the panel, a three-judge panel of the Court of Appeals. It was also a very emphatic decision written by Chief Judge McGee, very well-reasoned, full of historical information about the thinking of the legislature at the time, the language of the legislation, and a very thorough equal protection clause analysis. My hope is that they'll accept defeat at this point and that this shameful chapter in North Carolina's history can finally be closed.
Other than this issue and whether or not they will appeal, other than that legal question, John, is there anything that would now hold up the compensation program from going forward?
Well, there was another line of cases involving at least one plaintiff who was sterilized but not under the state eugenics program because the county involved didn't actually take the necessary legal steps to get it approved by the state eugenics board. That's a very sad case, and people like that certainly are deserving of compensation, but the law is clear that they're excluded because the law was written to compensate the victims of involuntary sterilizations by the board of eugenics. So that case was over a year ago. It hasn't been appealed. But I guess there's still maybe a possibility that that could come back to delay things as well.
Does that mean then that you're saying not only was there an official state program for eugenics and a state board, but local officials across North Carolina were in some cases just making these decisions themselves and doing
this? Well, we know for sure it happened at least once because we have the case for it. And my understanding from talking to some of the plaintiff's attorneys is there are several other, at least a few other cases where a similar thing happened. I don't know that this was a case of knowingly violating the law by those county officials, as it might have just been sloppy bookkeeping, but they didn't go through the proper legal steps to get these particular sterilizations approved by the state board.
The compensation program, you said there's a $10 million fund. Let's talk about the numbers here. Do we have a sense of how many people applied to have their case reviewed to see if they qualified for this and how many have been approved?
Well, there were actually almost 8,000 victims that we know of. The task force that originally promoted the compensation program estimated that there were between 2,000 and 1,500 living victims at that time. Over 700 people applied for compensation under the program. About 250 were actually qualified. So that's the number we're looking at, something in the, around 250 qualified recipients.
We're going to keep our eye on this situation with this particular case that we've just had the ruling from the North Carolina Court of Appeals on to see if those folks decide they are going to appeal to the North Carolina Supreme Court or if they're going to accept this decision. We'll have you back, John, to talk about then what happens next with this compensation program, a very sad, awful chapter of North Carolina history. Our guest has been John Guzet. He's Director of Legal Studies for the John Locke Foundation. Be sure and follow him at johnlocke.org and read his analysis. John, thank you.
Thank you, Donna.
That's all the time we have for Carolina Journal Radio this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.